I think this is a really complex spot that we're in right now.
Welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams.
You know, the way that we're holding space for each other, the act of me as a Black woman holding space for you as a white woman, I think that there are some people that would say that it isn't about you and that they wouldn't want to hear about how things are hard for you. They wouldn't want you to center your experience. And I think that there's truth to that.
Shame Booth is a podcast about getting proud. P-R-O-U-D. Proud. It is a big thing. And sometimes getting proud is about changing your story, about something you did, that you said, or you felt. But sometimes it could be much bigger than that. It can be about combating a shame that is global, something that we all carry because generations before us have instilled it in our culture, something that comes up again and again in jokes, sly remarks, or as the case may currently be with our current motherfucking government, race. In this episode, we're starting to scratch.
Literally.
Scratch the surface of how we talk about race, how we understand it, how we deal with it in our lives and the lives of those around us. We spoke to a colleague and a friend and a person we deeply admire who has chosen to remain anonymous due to some other projects that she's working on. The context we approached this in was through the lens of her Ivy League Harvard education. But believe me, that was just the starting point because we took a left turn, a right turn, we did a U-turn, we did some spin-outs. I mean, we started in one area and then we went a completely different area. All right, let me be honest here. This really was a hard conversation for me. And as you will hear, I even shed some white lady tears. Yeah, apparently hashtag white lady tears is a thing. But a little bit about me. Because the show is my show.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, I grew up in Texas. I'm a white woman living in a predominantly white county, and I really don't have many friends that are people of color. Although Tanya here, she's Armenian, so I guess that checks a box.
People always ask me why I'm so tan.
They always do.
I'm like, this is my color.
It's my color. Shit. Talk about shame. Oh, but this show is about talking about things we are most scared of. Approaching them with an open heart and a mind, starting a dialogue with others, with ourselves, with our kids, even with our parents. And hopefully the result of that trickles out into the world in an era when Trump and his cronies are chanting, send her back to people of color that are part of our government, people we've elected. It is high time that we get this conversation going. Here's take one, or maybe point five, or a quarter, or I don't know, it's a beginning. We start off by talking about how our guest felt when she was preparing for her 10-year reunion at Harvard. Have a listen.
I can start with a very prosaic, which was I wanted to look good.
Heck yeah.
Took myself to the gym and, you know, just trying to get this tight and right, as it were. I think I managed to get it there. But, you know, like it's the sort of thing you don't want to have to admit to yourself that I care so deeply about being able to fit into this size 6 dress because, you know, I want to impress people was, you know, the end of the sentence that I wasn't finishing in my head. Mm-hmm. So I think that was, you know, the start or just like on the surface, one of the things I was anxious about. The bigger thing, because body image is, it's almost comforting to think about that. It seems so much simpler for me of a problem. It's like either I'm going to be able to like hit this kind of goal
ideal?
Shape.
Number?
Ideal. It's not really so much of a number for me. The number is never really matched. I don't know, I've been lucky that I don't have to worry so much about the number. It's more like, oh, do I fit into these pants, mm-hmm. right? So yeah, it was, I think what kind of kept me up at night in the weeks leading up to reunion were just like how being at Harvard, it was tough at times. Absolutely. It was an experience that I'm really grateful for. And I think it pried me wide open in ways that, you know, like you get broken and then you get put back together. And I suspect that this is an experience that's not specific to Harvard, and that anytime a 17-year-old goes to college, they're going to go through this type of experience. But then you add all of the expectations and pressures that come with Harvard, and maybe that exacerbates things.
Mm-hmm. Was Harvard your first choice?
No. It was not my first choice. I didn't really think about college in that way. The first school I knew I might want to go to was Yale. And that was because I was a really big fan of Gilmore Girls, and the main character had just went to Yale. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching her, and I was like, oh, that seems fun.
And cute.
Yeah, and legit, that's the whole reason why I applied to Yale. It's because, you know, Rory Gilmore did it. So I think what was more of a driving force for me in high school is that I went to a majority Black school, and I got into my head that I really wanted to be valedictorian, because I had seen that at this majority Black school, the valedictorian was never Black when I was there.
It was a majority Black school.
Yeah.
And the valedictorian was never Black?
Yep. Yeah.
Hell yeah, you're going to get that.
That was, and I mean, like, Paula, let me be clear with you.
Yes.
I was not woke in high school.
Yeah.
By any measure. And so it's kind of interesting looking back to know that I had this goal that was so focused on representation, even though that really wasn't where my head was at in most of my life, you know, at that time. But yeah, this is what I really wanted. That's what I worked towards, and I didn't get it. Yeah, I was number 4 in my class. But I got into Harvard and Yale.
Yeah,
so.
Fuck them. You weren't valedictorian, but you got into Harvard.
And so it's like, I can't really, you know, smallest violin in the world is playing for me. I get it. When I got into Yale, so I applied to Yale early. And I applied early because I knew I was a procrastinator extraordinaire.
Yale? Mm-hmm. So you applied to Yale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was numero uno.
That was number one. And
okay. Again,
the only reason I applied is because Gilmore Girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied early because, yeah, I knew that it's a tendency to procrastinate. And I figured, all right, if I force myself to hit this deadline, then it'll be much easier for me to, you know, get my other applications done, get everything else figured out. So I applied. I remember I didn't get an interview. And so I just like, oh, I'm going to be rejected outright. I'm not even going to get on the wait list. And yeah, I think it was like the night of December 15th. Yeah, I think that's when it was. And checked my email and it just said, welcome to the class of 2008. And I went downstairs and told my mom, and I'd never seen her legs go up so high. She did these huge kicks, cheerleader kicks.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, yes, 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 yes. Yeah, which was, you know, I'm still talking about that mm-hmm. all these years later. It was a really wonderful moment.
Mm-hmm. But that was Yale.
Yeah.
You didn't go to Yale.
I didn't.
So, like, what the fuck happened between, like, reading it, mom doing high kicks, and then how does Harvard as a backup?
I mean, technically, I guess Yale was my safety school. I know.
Dude,
I know how that sounds.
It does. But you know what? I love that you could say that. You know, Yale as your safety school. Like, good for you.
I mean, I say it because, like, with no small amount of humiliation here. And, like, it's funny to me because, it's just, like, I was obviously incredibly privileged for everything to happen the way it did. You know, and Yale's an absolutely fantastic school. And I'm sure I would have been happy anywhere. And I think that's the real learning from all of this is, I think it's rich for me to say it doesn't matter where you go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to say that. Going to an Ivy League school opens doors for you. It just does.
Would this have happened if you were a white girl?
Would I have gotten in?
Had the choices?
Would I have had the choices between Yale and
Uh-huh.
Explain the question.
Well, I want to understand more about, because I don't, and this might come off as like complete ignorance, racism. I don't know. But that's why we have these conversations.
Uh-oh.
So I can learn.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, being, how do I want to ask this? Like, are they going to go to schools where there's a higher concentration of African-American kids?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to look at your transcripts. They're going to look at, you know, who you are as a whole person.
Mm-hmm.
And then are they going to try to add more diversity?
Hmm.
It's not affirmative action. I don't really know. But I mean, if you were to measure a white girl who had exactly the same profile and application and yourself, same, like everything is the same.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, would there be more or less opportunity? Because that seems like an anomaly for me that you had
mm-hmm.
Harvard to choose from and Yale to choose from and then other schools that you applied to
mm-hmm.
also accepted.
Yeah, I applied to, I mean, so when I got into Yale early and I had a list of 10 other schools, and my parents said they were not going to pay for application fees if I got into Yale. Either you go to Yale or you go someplace better. I was so naive. I didn't really know that much about the college process. You know, like, look at the reasons why I applied to these schools. I applied to Harvard because it was a common application. I didn't have to write any more essays.
You are smart.
I mean,
yeah, that makes sense.
You know, you cut the corners as you can to focus on what matters to you. So
did your parents go to are they highly educated? Did they come from really good colleges? And was it an expected thing in your family?
I think it was expected. It was expected that we were going to go to college. My parents have associate degrees, I believe. Yeah. So my parents are immigrants. They came to New York in the 70s, and yeah, they went to city colleges.
Mm-hmm. Which are great schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, thank God for city colleges.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, you're an immigrant. You want better for
you
your kids. You're a parent. You want better for your kids than what you had.
Here's where I get myself into these really awful pickles around.
Lay it on me, Paula.
No, just around race. Because, like, I was listening to Wanda Sykes
mm-hmm.
stand up last night.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, she's so fucking funny. She's like, if you don't have a black friend,
mm-hmm.
you're the problem.
Oh.
Speaking mostly to predominantly white audience. And I was like, oh my God, like, is my black friend.
Am I your only black friend?
Yes. Yes.
Paula.
And I.
Do you have other friends of color?
Well, define color.
Someone who isn't white?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
But not anybody who's African American. I mean, I've had stages of my life where I've had a couple boyfriends who were of color, black.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a circle of friends or even like the other parents
mm-hmm.
at my kids' school. There were a couple. And they were usually full-time, you know, they had to work.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't like stay-at-home moms who had the luxury of, you know, sending their kids off to school and go and play fucking tennis. Like, they had to work, whether
mm-hmm.
they were doctors or lawyers or whatever. But I just never had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the reasons why it's been important to have a relationship with you for me is just my personal growth as
mm-hmm.
a human being is to like have it. I'm going to get all like emotional. Oh my God. No, but it's, I mean, growing up how I did, it was like super racist.
Mm-hmm. Because you were growing up in Texas.
Yeah. In Texas. You know, my grandparents were from the South and, my other grandparents were from the North, but it was, you know, very segregated. And so, like, when you grow up in a household where that's what you see and that's what you're told, that's what you think.
Yeah.
Until you get away from it. So it's like, I feel like I'm a baby. in this because I just want to know more. I want to, I don't know. This isn't really about me, but it's trying to just start conversations with people who have had completely different experiences. And so I can have empathy and a different perspective.
Yeah.
Because I think that is why we're in such a shitty time and have been for a really long time. Like, if we don't have a conversation about race,
yeah,
we're not going to move forward.
I completely agree. And I want to thank you for being so vulnerable with me right now. I think this is a really complex spot that we're in right now. I mean, you know, we're in a couple of chairs in Sausalito, so in a way it's pretty simple, but
yeah,
it's, you know, the way that we're holding space for each other, the act of me as a Black woman holding space for you as a white woman. I think that there are some people that would say that it isn't about you and that they wouldn't want to hear about how things are hard for you.
Yeah.
They wouldn't want you to center your experience. And I think that there's truth to that. I also think that if you grow up a certain way and you only know certain things, then it's going to take some time to transition. It's going to take some time for you to learn and to grow.
Mm.
I just feel like we, I feel like it's going to be hard and it's not going to be perfect. And what that means is somebody is going to be your first Black friend. that's just the reality.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be me. I can say I don't want to do this work. And I think this is something that came up when we were talking with Kiese Lehman,
mm-hmm.
right? When you were asking a similar question. And he probably said something along the lines of, okay, you have to, Google's right there. It's
not his responsibility to educate me
right.
on his experience as
right.
a Black person. Because that's only one story.
It is only
number
one.
Story.
Yeah.
And number two, it's like, go do the fucking work, right? Don't put it on your Black friend to educate you about their experience. Like, go read, go learn, go explore, go put yourself out there and learn and ask questions. I think the tricky part sometimes is asking questions because they can be perceived as insulting, ignorant, you know, whatever it is. And you know me, I often, often ask questions that are taken either the wrong way when they're not meant to, or I put my foot in my mouth. It's like, but yeah, I ask questions and like, oh, and the other thing Wanda Sykes said last night too was don't ever ask a Black woman if you could touch her hair.
Oh yeah.
I touched her fucking hair.
That did happen. That did happen.
I felt so much shame after that. Oh, so much fucking shame. Even though I asked you, can I touch your hair? It's like you had it, you'd done this faux hawk thing. It was so cool. And I was just like, I just want to touch your hair. It's like, what the fuck am I thinking?
And it was, I mean, Paula, like it's, that was a hard moment for you afterwards. It was hard for me in the
was
moment.
Was it hard?
Well, yeah,
yeah,
for a few different reasons.
I bet.
In that,
I can only imagine. I have no idea why it would be hard.
What? Oh my goodness! Like all of this, you know, institutional bullshit that's like threaded into this one action. No, I mean, so there's that.
Yeah.
I think it's also that I know a little bit more about you. I know that you mean well, and it's. It feels like the best thing for me to have done in that moment would have been to what I hear a lot more these days, the language is to call in rather than call out. to, with compassion, share with you why that crossed the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And that was learning for me, because I'm not always as assertive as I should be
mm-hmm.
in that way. And yeah, I want to be someone that stands in my own truth and is able to grasp it.
So if I asked you again, can I touch your hair?
I would say no. I would say no, but let's have a conversation
yes.
about that. Yeah.
And I would want that.
Yeah.
I think most people...
I think you would want the conversation.
I would want the conversation.
I think I would feel like it would be a hard conversation.
Really?
Yeah.
So is that me putting it on you?
And that's what makes it complicated.
Like, to educate me about what's appropriate behavior. It's like, yeah. How are we going to ever... Well, I think we're doing it right now, right? We're having these conversations.
I think so. Yeah. I think we are.
What was it like for you at Harvard? Were there a lot of other kids of color or African American kids?
Harvard was pretty super diverse, yeah.
Less than 4%.
Oh, no. It was like...
I Googled black African American. Well, not African American because they do... It's international. Their international draw. But it said mm-hmm. black students was less than 4%.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's surprising. When I went there, it was... I think 10%.
Mm-hmm.
It was 10% black, and I think 8.5% Latinx, and 20% Asian, I believe. Wow, where am I pulling these numbers out of? I think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you're walking around, and it feels pretty diverse. They have all the freshmen living together. And like in Harvard Yard, and that's where you see all the pictures from the statue. You know, those are all freshman dorms, and it's like you have one Asian, one black person, one white person. It's really like United Colors of Benetton. That's
mm-hmm.
how they put everyone together. So you really do get this feeling that like wow, I am connecting with people from so many different backgrounds.
Which is interesting, like going back to someone who goes to a prestigious school
mm-hmm.
and even what we talk about, that city colleges, and there's many different paths
mm-hmm.
and it does not determine your happiness.
Not at all.
Or your success in this world.
Well, I mean, at Reunion, we had a panel discussion on success, on failure, really. And it was... one of the best parts of the weekend. I wasn't planning on going. Some friends were heading to that panel, and I just kind of walked in there and see like, oh, hey, what's up with this? And I recognized a whole bunch of people that were speaking. You know, these are people that I looked at when I went to Harvard, and, you know, they were movers and shakers, you know, on campus, and they were talking about ways in which over the last 10 years, they felt like they failed. You know, like they were talking about body image issues, about parents that didn't think they were good enough still.
This is cool. Were you surprised that they were having this kind of conversation?
To be so
open about.
Yeah, of course.
That's pretty cool.
It was more than cool. It was this really safe space. People were crying. People were like holding each other.
Was it jam-packed?
There were a lot of people, yeah. Yeah, and then afterwards I felt like that really set the tone for the rest of the weekend. The fifth reunion was fun. There was a lot of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of partying. I feel like maybe we were all, or at least for myself, I was still putting on airs, you know? I was still tending to the facade.
Mm-hmm.
The 10th, it really felt like we were at this inflection point. And, you know, like life had definitely dealt all of us some knocks.
Mm-hmm.
And we were being really open about it. You know, you talk to somebody and you say, how are you doing?
Like, and really?
Really, how are you doing? And people would say, I'm not really happy in my job. Or, you know, I got a divorce. And it felt like it gave you permission to talk about the things that weren't so shiny in your own life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Did you do that?
Yeah. In fact, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about what inspired you to do, you know, some recordings back at Reunion from Harvard. And they're pretty interesting. So tell me a little bit about that experience.
Oh, it was so much fun. Thank you, Shame Booth, really, mm-hmm. for giving me the opportunity to talk to people in this way.
Was it a helpful tool, like
yes.
a way in?
Oh, yeah.
That's good, yeah. Because you go back to those things and you're like, oh. That's why people get loaded.
Exactly. I mean, there's that aspect of it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, when you get drunk.
What did I say?
Yeah, what did I say? Or at least the social anxiety can be eased a little bit, and then you feel a little bit, get some confidence.
Yeah.
But it's good to have. Did you have a microphone?
I did.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I had this very clear, you know, people were like, oh, okay. And I've just always been so amazed at people's willingness to speak into a microphone. It's a miracle every time. Like, you really want to do this? Thank you. And yeah, people were super open. It's so clear to me that the resources at places like Harvard, yeah, unparalleled. The quality of education, I think you could get.
It's the connections and the resources.
It's the connections and the resources. And I just feel like, you know, you will be happy going in. Like, there are parents that'll be like, oh, how's my kid get in? Like, your kid will be happy in so many types of places. I guess it's kind of like dating. Like, you can be happy with so many types of people. It doesn't have to be this one person. It doesn't have to be this one school. It's like, I think Eve Ekman said something along these lines that we're just always becoming, mm-hmm. you know, and who we are yesterday isn't the same as who we are today. And there's like such freedom in that, you know?
So one other thing, let's see. Oh, I think we had this conversation too early on when we
did
met.
We?
Oh, it's another good one. It's like people go, I'm not racist. I don't see color. You know, I just don't see,
yes.
I just don't see color. And it's like, what do you think when people say that, and have people said that to you? And what does that mean?
Has anyone said that to me recently? I don't think so. I wouldn't mind if somebody did, because it's such a layup.
Yeah.
I'm gonna let you know.
Would you let them know?
Oh yeah, because
okay,
I mean that's, it's harder. What I think is hard, and therefore what I think is really interesting is this question of allyship, and you know what it is for people who are white to do the work.
Meaning
that I think it's important that I think that there is a role. There is a role for white people to play in moving society forward, right? Moving society forward out of racism, out of anti-blackness. Obviously, that role is often in talking to other white people and saying, you know, get on board.
Yeah.
And it's also in sharing your own experiences, you know, hopefully in a way that, you know, doesn't take a platform away from the marginalized people
yes.
who haven't had a chance to share
of
their
course.
Own experiences. But yeah, so I do think like again, the type of conversation that we're having right now, that I know people that would say, this is like, it's bullshit. Like,
oh,
why
know,
are you
I
crying?
I
literal
even,
white woman tears.
I don't even know if we're going to release this because I think it's going to sound.
But I think that's really brave.
White woman.
I mean, you know, it's
part
a thing.
Of your
it's
white woman tears.
It's a hashtag, Paula.
Is it?
It's a meme.
Oh my God, white woman tears.
Yeah, I can share it with you.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's also really key that, like, I'm not always going to want to do work. You know, some days I'm just going to need to, like, chill and take care of myself. Some days, like, I don't want to talk about race. I don't want to talk about blackness. I don't, you know, I absolutely don't want to be the voice of a people. I remember I had a job where I was.
I think we asked you that, too, in some meetings. We're like, you're black. You live in Oakland. What's
tell
that?
Us. Tell us.
Tell us.
You got your ear to the ground.
Yeah, and we're like,
tell us
I don't know.
What the black people are doing.
What are the black people doing?
Man. Yeah. So it's.
Okay, so you said you had a...
Yeah, I had a job where that was what I was asked to do. It was a marketing job. And we were, you know, marketing to the AA demographic is like what we called it, you know, the African-American demographic. And I had a weekend where I was supposed to be writing a brief for a campaign that we were pitching to, I forget, some client. And I couldn't do it. I was having a lot of feelings around being, you know, asked to speak to, like, asked to be an avatar for a people. And it felt really reductive. It felt, ugh.
Yeah.
I had so many feelings. It sucked.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And at the same time, I mean, no, that job was bullshit, but, or that particular assignment was bullshit. But I do think that, like, how, like, if I stretch out my hand, mm-hmm. it's going to help people to understand at least my experience a little bit better. And if that gets us to a place where, you know, we don't have white supremacists, like, in political power,
mm-hmm.
then that to me is worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's going to be hard. And it's not fair. It's not fair to me. But nothing about where we're at is fair.
Nothing.
So I'm acknowledging that for today, I am willing to have this conversation. I am willing to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And I can commit to right now.
Thank you.
Well,
have a great life.
Oh, no. You too.
Today.
Today.
I never know how to end these.
That's good.
Here's to you. Your insight, wisdom, wit, and willingness to walk me and our listeners through these very, very murky waters. Let this be the start of many more conversations to come. As we discussed, race is tied to so many aspects of our culture, not least of which is education. It wasn't that long ago that schools became desegregated in the U.S., and the truth is, segregation in schools is pretty rampant. But what happens when you go to an elite school? Some say one of the best in the world, Harvard. How does that affect your identity around belonging and success? Two issues that, regardless of race, we all grapple with. Our guest interviewed some of her fellow Harvard students when she went back there for her 10-year reunion. Here's some excerpts from those conversations.
All right. Good morning, Cambridge. I just woke up, got in to the dorms last night, and you feel like you have something you want to show off. You know, it's a fancy job. It's the beautiful partner and your gorgeous, well-adjusted kids. It's your banging bod and your chic clothes. You know, there's something you want other people to look at and admire you for, and I think that's the same at college reunions happening all over the country right now. What may be different about going to reunion here at Harvard are the incredible expectations that we put on ourselves, that others put on ourselves, friends, family, random people that find out you went here and they want to be impressed. You want to be impressed. Honestly. You know, you look around here at reunion and, you know, somebody here runs a Fortune 500 company. No, I mean, really, when I came here for the 5th year reunion, we ran into Marissa Mayer. And then we tried to stalk her and ask her questions. Didn't work out. But it proves the point, right? Like, there are people who are in incredible positions of power. You know, they might run countries. They cure cancer. They, you know, agitate for social change, do incredible philanthropy. It's really cool what people are up to, like how creative and and prolific they can be. And there's this sense that that person who's making all of these things happening, all these important things happening, that could be you. And you feel it when you walk around this campus, the drive and the ambition.
Hi. I miss you. Bring it in here.
I miss you so much.
Hi. I love you.
I love you.
Oh my God, how's your life?
Good.
How's your life?
Better now that you're here.
Of course. Likewise. It's perfect.
Hi.
Hear more about what you think shame is, and if you've had experiences that connect with that word when you were at Harvard.
I don't know if this is shame, but I do feel embarrassed to wear stuff that says Harvard on it. So I have a bunch of like Harvard paraphernalia, and I usually just wear it around the house as like pajamas, and then I always feel like a little bit like, you know, when you see other people wearing their like school colors or their school like t-shirts or sweatshirts or whatever, it feels like there's no way to do it without being kind of braggy.
Moving to Boston.
to that point, where do you guys say you went to school? In Boston, in Cambridge, or at Harvard?
In Boston.
So you never say you went to Harvard?
If they ask me specifically, like, which college I went to, like, I will, like, tell them. But I wouldn't tell them, like, right off the bat.
I still don't know how to answer that question in a way that doesn't... Like, if someone is primed to be like, ugh, they're going to do it either way. Because if you either say Harvard and they're going to be, like, right off the bat, you know, it's a little, like, strange or, what you know, awkward. Or you say, oh, Boston, and they say, where in Boston? And you say, just outside Boston. And then they say, like, where? Huh. And then they feel like you've just been, like, doing it on purpose, building it up, so there's no good way to do it.
A few times, I think when I was in college, I said Boston, mm-hmm. And...
You were called out.
I was called out, yeah. And people were like, you don't think I could handle this? I can take it. It's just a school. And so it was just like, oh, yeah. It's essentially what it was. It's like, yeah, you can't handle the truth. So ever since then, I stay Harvard, but you, like, really have to stick the dismount. You know what I mean? Like, if you wobble at all, people catch it, and they jump all over you. So, yeah, that's a good technique.
They see the weakness, and then they go for the kill.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say, related with shame, I actually think, like, imposter syndrome after Harvard is super interesting, because my first two bosses, like, recently in my job, I felt like they were super critical of me, and one of the examples they gave was, like, we thought you would be so high-performing because, like, we saw your resume, you're from Harvard, you actually went to Harvard twice, and then, like, it's, like, basically, like, they wanted to use my background as a way to shame me, which I found, like, super fascinating to me of, like, you know, like, I already proved myself. I went there. Like, why should I, like, you know, sort of, like, have to prove it to you?
Shame, shame, shame.
Shame, shame, shame.
Shame, shame, shame.
Shame, shame, shame.
So for me, shame is going to be when you've got a gap between what you feel you should have done and what you feel you did do, which is a whole lot of self-judgment. You're going to not live up to perfection a lot. And if you turn that gap into shame all the time, you're just going to have a tough time. So I view it pretty negatively, even as much as I create it for myself more often than I should. It's also interesting here because if you're just going to get your college degree and go out into the world, there's a perception here that that's a kind of failure. You mean you're not getting your master? You're not getting a PhD? What, you know?
I think that's something that a lot of people have difficulty doing, is letting go of that idealized picture of what success should look like. Is that your experience talking to other classmates here? You know, are people still struggling with what that looks like?
It's hard question because the people who are really struggling aren't here. I know that in the past, times when I was really struggling, I didn't show up. But, you know, do I think I'm successful? Not a word I use a lot. I am completely unambitious. There are times when I still beat myself a little bit when I see someone else who has, quote unquote, succeeded in some particular way. And I was like, well, I could have done that, I think, and I would have been really unhappy. So maybe it's just as well. Do what you can do, and that will turn into something. So, which is, you know, there's no shame in that.
Perfect. Thank you.
You are very welcome.
So I'm back at my freshman dorm, and I forgot how pretty it is. Like, all the trees are in bloom. There's this big bush right next to me that's like exploding with white flowers. I mean, literally, there's flower petals that are fluttering down all around me. It's actually kind of magical. I remember how much of the freshman class, how much me and my friends and even the people I didn't know, a lot of us really felt like frauds. You know, a lot of us had a mild to severe case of imposter syndrome. There was a Facebook group called I'm the Admissions Mistake. 40% maybe, 60%, some very large percentage of my class was in this group. Like, we all thought we didn't belong.
Wow, that's really powerful stuff. You know, I've struggled with what it means to be successful. Shame Booth certainly has helped me through that. And that's what I love about this project. It is not just a podcast. It's a place where people come to shed their shame and get proud. The idea just started as a booth, and that booth has grown and traveled. And now we're making a portable booth that you can fit in your suitcase. I swear, I don't know how he's going to do it, but Philip is onto something. I think it's his new glasses.
I think it's his new glasses.
Anywho, here's some clips from the booth.
I'm ashamed that I can think opposite ideas at the same time. Cognitive dissonance. I'm a school teacher, and when I'm talking to my students, I tell them I believe in all of them, and that they've all got a chance, and they're all beautiful, intelligent, different people. And I believe it. But then I turn around and I still laugh at kids who are kind of ugly or say stupid things. And when their parents don't have them set up for success and I can't make a difference with them, sometimes I feel like I give up on them, even though I would never describe myself as the kind of person who would. It's confusing, and it doesn't feel good, but it does feel real that you can acknowledge institutional racism but still benefit from it. Explain it to kids who are suffering under it and tell them they can beat it, but I don't know if that's true. So all I can do is tell them the nice things, tell them the support things, because I know that's at least what I can give them, even though on the inside I'm thinking some shameful shit. Thank you very much. Donate to your public school if you can.
In this moment, what's coming up for me around shame is that I care deeply and I'm committed to racial justice in the world. And I'm a white woman, and I have grown up in communities of color, and I feel very connected to the deep need to restore dignity and respect and connection across racial lines specifically. And yet I have like one of my closest and deepest connections with a girlfriend, sister of mine, who's a African-American woman who really feels as though I have been racist towards her. And it's just, one, stretched me because I really have tried to be resourced and hear her, and for some reason she doesn't feel heard, and I don't think she's wrong, and I don't think I'm wrong, and I'm still completely confused because it's a skill set I teach, and it's a skill set I care about, and it's the world that I want to create in the world, and I don't know how to do it, and it feels like fundamentally, like, I feel that this particular relationship, which is why it stresses me out and makes me feel ashamed, it's like, this is one of my oldest friends. This is someone that I've lived with and cared about and traveled with and done so many things with. Like, if they could think this about me, then, you know, like, am I a total hypocrite? Do I stop what I am trying to do in the world? Like, how do I continue doing it and acknowledge that clearly there's more work to be done and not feel like conflicted and honor her and yet honor myself that is just really hurt and confused by it? And yeah. And every time I want to figure out, I've tried something different, it sort of keeps producing the same result, which is like triggering us both and hurting us more. And so I just can't let it go, but I really, really am confused, and that's so hard, because I want to help other people deal with this exact situation, and yet in one of my deepest relationships, I'm lost myself. Thank you for listening.
Being a Black woman in a society that celebrates Eurocentric features is really hard. I try my best to be strong. I try to remind myself that I am worthy, I am loved, and I am enough, but a lot of times I feel like I fall short. It's hard every day when you feel like you're not enough, when you feel that who you are will never be enough or be celebrated. And I hope that we as a society can move forward, because I don't want anyone to ever feel the way I do most days out of the year.
Thank you to everyone who has the strength or just the sheer will and sense of adventure to walk into the booth. We're working on a home for Shame Booth in the fall. It's a secret, but as you know, you don't need the shame booth to shed your shame. In fact, you can tell your friends, your family, talk to your dog. I do. She just looks at me. She doesn't judge me. You could write it down somewhere, burn it in the fire. Or guess what? You can just call the shame line, 415-890-4802. We have a place where you can call in and get proud. To learn more, please go to shamebooth.org. Shame Booth, the podcast, is produced by Sound Made Public with Tanya Katenjian right here.
Hello.
Isn't she adorable? She's Armenian. And Philip Wood with new glasses, seeing the world in a whole new way. And Shame Booth, the team, is me, Paula Williams, Retta Rowland, and the Shame Dames that represent at events all over the country. We thank you. Please visit the site and hear some clips from the booth. Call the Shame Booth hotline, 415-890-4802. Get free, get proud, and have conversations about all the tough stuff. It's messy and uncomfortable, but I tell you, it's worth it. Thanks for listening. We recording?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. You got the whole toot in there and, like, me sniffing my armpits going, gamey at 53.
I do have it.
53? I thought you were 50.
No, man. I look good.
I thought, oh, well, no, you look much better than 50.
Okay, let's talk shame. Shame Booth is a podcast about getting proud.
Mm.
Getting proud. P-R-O-U-D. It's a big thing. So the context... Oh, my hip. I gotta...
It's something that happens in your 50s.
My hip, my leg. I need Sam the body man. Sam the body man. Oh, thank you so much, dear friend. Oh, thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you so... That just sounds like phony bullshit. I smell like a goat. Oh, thank you. I don't know why I say it with disdain, probably because I didn't stand a fucking chance getting into that place. Wow. That's really powerful, man.
Man.
Dom arigato to everyone who is... No, that's culturally inappropriate. See, I'm trying to be culturally appropriate without offending anybody.
Wait, what? No, you're not offending someone? You're trying not to offend?
It is a powerful experience. I shit you not.
Although you might have just taken a shit.
I did. When
you tooted.
Just came back from retreat and I ate vegetables for 5 days and shit my pants like 3 times in the airport. Anyway, Shame Booth is going to have a home for several weeks.
Oh,
it's a secret. Shh. Be quiet. Yeah, baby.
I love that place.
Okay, that's it for today. I need a nap. I'm a
straight talker.
I'm a straight shooter. I am. I'm straight. Well.
Well, kind of.
I like girls.
I like that.
I do. And you know what? I'm also kind of smiling right now because I realize how much I love this project.
I know, me too.
Oh, anyway.
It's really good.
It's very cool. So welcome to Shame Booth. This is our podcast. I'm Paula Williams.